at high speeds, end of quote. North Williams Street is a common bike route, and with the new plan, bikers would cross the entrance of the I-5 on-ramp and two right turn lanes connected to that off-ramp. Portland's Pedestrian Advisory Committee drafted a letter to urge the Portland Bureau of Transportation, known as PBOT, to withdraw its support from the project design because of that safety issue. The estimated cost of the project is $1.45 billion, and construction is scheduled to start sometime this year. ODOT Urban Mobility Director Brendan Finn says the surface street design in and around I-5 is still in the early stages. Finn wrote to the Mercury, quote, "Safety is ODOT's priority, and this report's purpose is to identify all impacts so we can work with the community, the City of Portland, and other partners to address all safety concerns as design of the cover progresses." So how could that off-ramp be made more safe? It could include restricting cars from turning right on red where the bike lane crosses, extending sidewalk corners, or having phased traffic signals that give cyclists and pedestrians time to move independently of car traffic. ODOT is currently reviewing public comment on the Rose Quarter project design. The City of Portland is considering moving forward with an experimental surveillance system called ShotSpotter. The technology detects gunshots and is monitored by police. It's faced resistance in Portland, where council members could approve a plan to bring that technology to the city. A 2021 study from the MacArthur Justice Center found that it led to more than 40,000 dead-end police deployments in Chicago in less than 2 years. Eric Tegedoff has more on the pushback from a recent Faith, Peace, and Action collaborative meeting.
Community members continue to voice concerns about gunshot detecting technology being considered in Portland. At a recent Interfaith Peace and Action Collaborative meeting, opponents of the technology known as ShotSpotter pointed out its weaknesses. Jonathan Menis is an attorney at the MacArthur Justice Center in Chicago, where the ShotSpotter surveillance system has been implemented. He says there are no published studies about how the technology responds to loud noises, and notes that every time it's triggered, police are expecting to find someone armed and potentially dangerous.
To the extent that the system is being triggered by loud noises like fireworks, cars backfiring, etc., it's creating unnecessary dangerous situations and putting people under false suspicion.
Supporters of the ShotSpotter program say it's necessary to address the growing number of gun deaths in Portland. But a 2021 study from the MacArthur Justice Center found it led to more than 40,000 dead-end police deployments in Chicago in less than 2 years. A ShotSpotter spokesperson says the report draws erroneous conclusions from its interpretation of police reports. Jay Amechi with the Portland-based group Freedom to Thrive also spoke at the Interfaith meeting. She says a more equitable response to gun violence would be to help lift people out of poverty.
Spending thousands of dollars and even millions on a system that primes police to see underserved people in a particular region as armed assailants, that is not an equitable use of data in any kind of way. And the idea that could be an equitable use of data, I mean, it escapes reason.
The ShotSpotter contract with Portland could be worth up to $1 million a year. Sarah Hamed with the Carceral Tech Resistance Network in Portland spoke at the meeting as well. She says there are racial disparities in how the ShotSpotter technology has been implemented in other cities.
So when we think about why it is that people are starting to feel that technology is racist, it might just be because old racisms are being recuperated through scientific language.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler's office is developing a proposal for the council on ShotSpotter, but has not yet established a timeline for when it would be introduced. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Well, this is for the birds, literally. $2 million will be going to the Oregon Zoo thanks to funding from the year-end omnibus bill signed by President Joe Biden. The money will aid in the conservation of the California condor, an endangered bird species. The Condor Restoration Resiliency Project aims to modernize the zoo's off-site Clackamas County Johnson Center for Wildlife Conservation. The center is the second largest of the nation's four condor breeding facilities. Travis Coons runs the project, and Coons said, quote, "They were the first animal to be added onto the Endangered Species Act in the 70s, and they're one of the more charismatic animals and really important success stories in the conservation realm," end of quote. Wildfires and power outages forced recent evacuations at the center, and plans to upgrade the electrical backup systems are in the works. The center will also use the $2 million to create wildfire resiliency at the center and plans to purchase equipment to improve fire breaks and add protective coatings to barns. The California condor was nearly extinct when it was put on the endangered species list, and in 1982, only 22 condors remained in the wild. By 1987, the last condors were brought under human supervision in an attempt to save the species from extinction. The Oregon Zoo joined the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service condor recovery effort back 2003. That recovery partnership aims to hatch and release as many condors as possible. Nowadays, there are around 500 condors, with more than 300 flying free. This year, the zoo hatched a record 12 condor chicks and released 8. President Biden makes his first trip to the southern border, and former President Trump says he did the country a favor by helping Representative Kevin McCarthy become speaker. Catherine Carley has those stories and more with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
But the president who caused the chaos of the border needed to be here.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott harshly criticized President Joe Biden as Air Force One touched down near El Paso, where a record number of migrants are arriving each day. Biden inspected a stretch of the U.S.-Mexico border and met with officials to discuss an increase in fentanyl trafficking tied to a spike in overdoses. The administration also just announced a new plan to consider the asylum claims of up to 30,000 migrants a month from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
But I do want to especially thank President Trump. I don't think anybody should doubt his influence.
Newly minted House Speaker Kevin McCarthy made sure to thank former President Donald Trump after the longest fight over the gavel since the Civil War. Trump also made sure to thank himself, writing on his Truth social media platform that by helping the Republican leader, he did the country a big favor. Following McCarthy's victory, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York rallied fellow Democrats around their legislative successes of the past 2 years, including the American Rescue Plan and the Inflation Reduction Act.
It was one of the most consequential Congresses in American history.
Jeffries predicted the concessions McCarthy had to make to far-right lawmakers to win their votes are just the beginning of dysfunction in the House. Jeffries tells NBC an extremist agenda has now been negotiated into House rules and will hobble the functioning of Congress. Supporters of Brazil's far-right ex-president Jair Bolsonaro clashed with police and vandalized the presidential palace, Congress, and Supreme Court. The attack comes 1 week after the inauguration of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro claimed without evidence that the election was stolen before claiming asylum in Florida. Some U.S. officials are comparing the attacks to January 6th and calling for his extradition back to Brazil.
There are those in the state who do not understand the urgency of the crisis.
Maryland Governor-elect Wes Moore should have little resistance in acting policies related to climate change now that Democrats control both the governor's office and the state legislature. Climate activists hope Democratic leaders in Massachusetts, Michigan, and Minnesota will also use their new trifecta of statehouse control to pursue environmental policies rejected by previous Republican leaders. Democratic Colorado Governor Jared Polis is pausing a plan to bus asylum seekers to Chicago and New York after complaints from their mayors. In a letter to Polis, they say they are over capacity after receiving hundreds of migrants from Colorado. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Listening to the KABU Evening News. Make sure you stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in depth. Then at 6 p.m. it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Taking a look at your weather, it's going to be cloudy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow, a little bit of clearing, partly cloudy with a high of 50, with scattered showers here and there. Today in history, in 1941, American musician and activist Joan Baez was born. Baez has had an over 60-year career in contemporary folk music and as a political and social activist related to nonviolence, civil rights, human rights, and the environment. The quote of the day is from Joan Baez, who said, "Action is the antidote to despair." this year when a typhoon slammed Alaska's coast, FEMA officials didn't provide adequate translations for two Alaska native languages. For indigenous language speakers in the state, it caused confusion and frustration. Antonia Gonzalez has more with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. After a powerful typhoon slammed into Alaska's west coast in September, the Federal Emergency Management Agency tried to offer information about how to apply for disaster recovery assistance in two Alaska Native languages. But as Emily Schwing reports, those translations were not useful to any Indigenous language speakers in the state.
Dozens of Alaska Native villages along the state's west coast were hit hard by Typhoon Murbach. So FEMA hired a California-based company to translate press releases and documents about how to apply for disaster recovery fund into Yupik. The agency also asked for Inupiaq translations. Tom Kempton is a FEMA spokesperson.
And it wasn't until, you know, we started doing some of those translations that I don't speak, you know, Yupik. What we were seeing coming back, I mean, when I first saw the Inupiaq ones, I was like, what is this? It was all like hieroglyphic.
Indigenous language speakers across Alaska didn't recognize the languages. Linguist Gary Holton spent 20 years at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Native Language Center. He says someone lifted full phrases from an 80-year-old compilation of folklore language that was printed in the Soviet Union.
Can you maybe imagine if someone, you know, took all of your folk tales and then interviewed your great grandmother about her experiences growing up and had all of this information recorded and wrote it down and then scrambled it and stuck it in various different ways. It would and made kind of a collage out of it. It's offensive.
That's egregious.
Tara Sweeney is the former Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs under the Trump administration. She calls the work a waste of federal funds.
I'm absolutely speechless. I cannot believe that a contractor would put something like this together for the federal government and that there is no verification of whether this is accurate and that the federal government would actually issue this as a work product of their own.
According to FEMA, the agency paid $27,800 to California-based company Accent on Languages. The work was supposed to help fluent indigenous speakers apply for financial assistance following Typhoon Murbach. In Bethel, I'm Emily Schwing.
A Canadian woman has decided to have her trial heard by a judge. Dawn Walker is accused of abducting her child and having their deaths faked. She's facing a number of charges. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Walker and her 7-year-old son were reported missing in July. After a search of 2 weeks, they were found safe in Oregon. That after she illegally crossed the border into the U.S. Authorities there have also brought charges against her. She was returned to Saskatoon in August and has waived her right to jury trial and elected to have her case heard by a judge. Ari Goldkind is a criminal defense lawyer. He says going before a judge alone is a tactical decision.
When you have all of the things that a jury will hear this woman allegedly did, the list, that may be something that a jury may really, really dislike, particularly is there a divorced dad or two on that jury.
Walker is a longtime employee of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations, where she serves as CEO. A U.S. official also alleges Walker stole the identity of a close friend to open a bank account as part of an abduction plan. Walker is also believed to have been in a custody battle with her son's father. Her trial dates will likely be set this week. National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Breakdowns after Hurricane Maria left some domestic abuse survivors in an especially dangerous situation. A Puerto Rico group helps protect abuse survivors during and after disasters. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2017, Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico. Many people had no electricity, cell service, or drinking water. Government agencies' emergency responders were overwhelmed, and communication systems broke down. For some domestic abuse survivors, it was an especially dangerous situation.
You didn't know if your protection order was in place, and then you have no protocols in place for the emergency shelters, and Puerto Rico is made up of very small communities. So it's very likely that you will end up your abuser in the same emergency shelter.
Tanya Rosario Mendez directs Tire Salud, a nonprofit focused on women's health and violence reduction. She says after the storm, her group visited shelters daily and offered guidance on how to protect women.
And we had some master lists of victims and survivors from our program, so we located all of them and we helped get some victims out of the island so that they would be safer.
She says since Maria, groups on the island developed protocols and training to better protect women in emergencies. But she says abuse survivors are especially vulnerable when disasters strike. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Data from a study this past fall shows in the United States, colleges and universities saw a widening gender gap in enrollment declines. It found that women in their first year are experiencing the worst of it. A Minnesota group says it aligns with barriers young women face, especially women of color, in the midst of a crisis that hurt their economic prospects. Mike Moen has the details.
Higher education experts say a concerning trend has emerged in the pandemic, declining college enrollment among young women. Those pushing for greater equity at the college level say it appears to be another roadblock for women of color. The National Student Clearinghouse Research Center says across the U.S., freshman college enrollment for women last fall fell by more than 3% compared to 1.2% for men. Ikram Mahmoud of the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership says it isn't out of the question to connect those numbers to the challenges families have faced during the crisis.
We know that women of color are more likely to come from lower family incomes. So even with the pandemic and so many people losing opportunities, women of color have had to step up in different ways to either take care of the family, find another job.
Mahmoud adds while high school graduation rates have improved for women of color in Minnesota, access to college has long been more difficult. That's mainly due to affordability. She says the pandemic has made those limited opportunities even smaller, leaving these young women to mostly consider lower-paying jobs. Mahmoud points out that jobs that don't require a college degree provide a steady income skew mainly towards men.
Long-haul trucking, construction, a lot of male-dominated opportunities that women don't have access to tend to pay family-sustaining wages. In Minnesota.
Minnesota does have a goal of ensuring that 70% of adults ages 25 to 44 and across all racial and ethnic groups have attained a post-secondary certificate or degree by 2025. But Mahmoud said to meet those benchmarks, financial aid reform is needed, including the Minnesota State Grant Program. She notes it's outdated in recognizing the unique economic challenges students of color often contend with. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
Sustainable development is an important part of both reducing climate pollution and meeting the demand for housing, offices, industrial, and retail spaces. Experts say repurposing older buildings is significantly more sustainable than doing new construction. Preserving historic buildings can also increase economic activity through tourism and local job creation. Eric Galatis has more.
A changing climate is prompting many developers to consider how their work can be more sustainable and how they can produce housing, retail, and office space in ways that meet the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. University of Wyoming architectural engineer Anthony Detter says that in virtually all cases, the greenest building is the one that already exists.
Which means that almost always, if you can reuse an existing building rather than building new construction, you're going to have a lower kind of environmental footprint.
Concrete, bricks, and steel all come with a lot of what's called embodied energy, Denzer explains, the energy needed to mine raw materials, refine them, and bring them to job sites. Adapting buildings with those materials already in place immediately reduces a project's carbon footprint. New construction typically happens on the edge of towns, which Denzer says requires additional energy to build out roads, utilities, and other infrastructure that already exists closer to Main Street. Wyoming towns that have prioritized preserving older buildings have seen positive economic impacts. Denzer says historic buildings tend to draw tourists who spend money at bed and breakfasts, restaurants, and gas stations, and the work required for renovating older buildings puts money into the pockets of local carpenters, plumbers, and electricians.
Studies have shown that adaptive reuse generates more jobs and more economic activity compared to new construction, and there are local physical jobs.
Denzer says almost every community in Wyoming has at least one building, perhaps an old school or industrial space that has potential. He points to the former Union Pacific Roundhouse in Evanston as one example. After sitting dormant for decades, the site where trains were once parked and serviced has been transformed into a convention center and the town's city hall.
Just a jewel of a building, really impressive old brick construction with beautiful details. Kind of thing, again, a community doesn't want to lose because it would be losing part of its history.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
A 2022 study found high levels of dangerous chemicals in 67 West Virginia public water systems. West Virginia lawmakers are expected to introduce legislation called the Clean Drinking Water Act of 2023 this session. It would take steps to regulate PFAs, known as PFAS, in drinking water. Nadia Amdon has more.
West Virginia lawmakers are expected to introduce legislation in 2023 aimed at regulating PFAS chemicals in the state's drinking water systems, commonly found in Teflon cookware, water-resistant clothing, fast food packaging, and other consumer goods. PFAS have been linked to cancer, immune suppression, neurodevelopmental disorders, thyroid disease, decreased fertility, and other conditions. Luann McGovern with the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy explains that the Clean Drinking Water Act of 2023, modeled after last year's House Bill 4055, would outline a strong set of actions to curb residents' exposure to chemicals.
The legislature, first off, wants to set state-specific maximum contaminant levels for certain PFAS chemicals. They also want to establish a PFAS response team to go after some of the really high areas. They also want to require facilities that are using PFAS to report their use.
Last summer, the EPA released drinking water health advisories for some PFAS compounds, listing the threshold of contamination least likely to cause harm to human health. The advisories are only recommendations and are not enforceable. Last week, the agency released its new PFAS database, which it says will help public health experts and scientists better understand potential PFAS sources in their communities. A federal study released in 2020 found PFAS in 67 West Virginia public water systems, out of more than 200 tested. McGovern points out the bulk were concentrated along the Ohio River, in the Parkersburg area, and in the Eastern Panhandle, all highly populated regions.
I think that having this study has really empowered people to go to their local water treatment, their local town, city, and say, hey, what are you doing with this? What are we doing to put in the right equipment to be taking PFAS out of our drinking water?
Meanwhile, some manufacturers are moving away from using the chemicals. The company 3M announced last month a plan to phase out PFAS by the end of 2025. This is Nadia Ramlagan for West Virginia News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 9th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and David Rosenberg. Fritzer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, Catherine Carley, Mike Moen, Eric Galatis, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. Just a reminder, all of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. That is great people like you. If you'd like to become a member, and we certainly hope that you do, please support our programming by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. Have a great night.
This is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. Whereas the Western media tends to portray U.S. aid to Ukraine as part of an attempt to help the Ukrainians defend their sovereignty against the Russian invasion, some critics of U.S. policy, like retired Princeton University professor of international law Richard Falk, say that Washington is really pouring gasoline on the Ukraine fire. Falk spoke with KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Berg, who asked him if he thought the Biden administration felt it had to keep supporting Ukraine or risk being seen as weak in the face of aggression.
I